You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I don't really look at it as political or spiritual or environmental. It's just art.
Those that were using sacred imagery willy-nilly was really offensive to me.
I want someone to be able to look at Native people as they are now.
From WNYC in New York, I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Just a few days from now, a new museum opens on the Mall in Washington, D.C. It's the National Museum of the American Indian, and it occupies the last bit of open real estate on the Mall, next to the Wright Brothers airplane at the Air and Space Museum, and a few blocks from the Lincoln Memorial. To start our show today, we'll get a glimpse of the new Indian Museum, and then take this opportunity to talk with the writer Sherman Alexie about American Indian culture and about being an Indian artist in the 21st century. We sent our own Ave Carrillo down to Washington to visit the Museum of the American Indian during the final days of construction last month.
I've been walking down the Mall all day, and my feet hurt, and I'm incredibly grumpy. Suddenly, the 12-year-old inside me stomps her feet and screams, if I have to go into yet another museum in addition to the dozens already on the Mall, this 12-year-old is going to have a little tantrum. But the adults at the newly built National Museum of the American Indian would say, no, really, this museum is going to be different. And at least from the outside, the NMAI really is quite different from all the other clipped lawns and marble temples of art, history, and science. Although the work isn't quite finished, I find myself in a landscape that clearly looks like a fledgling forest. It quickly morphs into a miniature swamp that will end in a water fountain. And the ochre-colored limestone building was designed to look as though it was slowly carved out over millions of years by water and wind. Whereas every other museum on the Mall faces each other across the Mall, the NMAI's entrance faces away, due east, which its designers were really adamant about. Donna House is an ethnobotanist and is on the design team for the Museum Building and Landscape. She's Navajo of the Towering House Clan, and Oneida of the Turtle Clan.
In this case, our door is facing the sun, our relative, the sun. Because as you're walking in, we want you to shed all the experience of the other museums.
They've tried to make this corner of the Washington Mall a native place, represented by ecosystems traditionally essential to Native Americans. 28,000 plants and 8 different kinds of soil were trucked in from all over North America, and each and every one has some sort of symbolic meaning.
As you can see here, we have the dead bald cypress laying there, and a young one coming up, which represents renewal.
So you purposefully put a dead tree in there?
Yes, it's all part of life. It's all part of recycle, it's all part of renewal. And everything is dynamic here in this landscape, so that's what it represents.
The focus outside is gathering and preserving native habitats and traditions. Inside, curators are preparing exhibits of ancient artifacts and modern art by Native Americans. But the staff at the NMAI believe that returning sacred objects to their original tribes may even be more important than displaying them. The practice is officially called repatriation and is legally required for every museum in America. But Bruce Bernstein, the assistant director of the museum's Cultural Resource Center, says repatriation isn't all that easy.
We've worked with one group. We have about 390 pieces which are of cultural, religious concern to them. They're bundles. And this group knows all about this, and in 15 years of trying, we've gotten 2 returns so far. So it's not always just a matter of sending them back, but communities need to be prepared to take them back. There need to be the right families, the right societies. So even in the best of our intentions, it doesn't happen just automatically.
So far, only 2,500 out of 800,000 objects have been repatriated. So the museum has done the next best thing. built a special facility where Native people can come to use the collections or even borrow them for ceremonies, like some regalia that came from the Hoopa tribe of Northwest California. Wendy George, a Hoopa member, found the regalia in the collection when she was advising museum staff on an exhibit about her tribe. It had belonged to her grandmother and was used in the tribe's white deerskin dance. Here's Bruce Bernstein.
So Wendy asked that she could borrow it, and she asked that the curator, Emil Hermanyhorses, hand carry it back to her community, because Wendy and her family felt that the museum, having it in their possession all these years, made the museum then part of that ceremony. And it was very important that Emil travel personally and bring that to the community and witness the dance as well. And when the dance was over, Emil then brought the piece back.
You have to understand that up until the last decade or two, if you didn't have a PhD or you weren't an anthropologist or have a master's degree in one of the sciences, the doors were closed to you.
Jim Pepper Henry is head of repatriations and community services at NMAI and a member of the Muscogee and Kaw tribes.
And what we're doing, we're opening the doors for everybody, and especially for Native Americans, where the doors have been closed for so many years, and our door will always be open.
For Studio 360, I'm Ave Carrillo.
The National Museum of the American Indian opens to the public on the 21st of this month. I'm Kurt Anderson, and in Studio 360 today, we're using the new museum as an occasion to talk about what it means to be a living, breathing Indian artist right now in the 21st century. And my guest today is Sherman Alexie, and he's thought about that question a lot. He's a funny, smart, thoughtful writer, as well as a poet and film director and occasional stand-up comic. Alexie grew up in the Spokane Reservation in eastern Washington. He gave up an early dream to become a doctor and, luckily for us, instead became one of the most interesting younger fiction writers in America today. Sherman Alexie, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. And I want you to know that my door is facing east at this moment as well. So
I'm very pleased about that. Now, you don't take all of that solemn facing east tribal tradition stuff entirely seriously, do you?
Well, I don't take anybody's traditions entirely seriously. But as I was listening to that report, I thought, well, that's great. That's, you know, respecting religion, respecting culture, and establishing a sense of sovereignty in a good sense of the word. But it's also establishing separation in the bad sense of the word.
But isn't that a kind of tension that any group in the melting pot of America faces, of how separate to be, how integrated to be?
Well, I think it's different for us because, you know, politically speaking, we are separate. The fight is for sovereignty. We are, by treaty rights, supposed to be treated as separate nations within a nation. So I think on a political level, we are fighting for our economic and political independence. At the same time, we are seeking cultural assimilation and respect. So I'm not sure if the museum is viewing it that way. I hear about the dead tree in the front to symbolize all parts of life. But as I was hearing that, I thought, yeah, what about the car wreck? Is there going to be a crashed car into the wall, with like beer bottles scattered around, which is a huge part of Indian life? It's a museum and it's a government museum. It's going to focus on, for lack of a better word at the moment, a positive view of the struggle rather than a more holistic, well-rounded view of our struggles.
Well, your work of stories, much of it about Indian people living now, certainly takes that kind of whole view, warts and all. Do you feel as though you single-handedly are providing the counterpoint to that kind of nice facing east dead tree neutrality of the museum?
Single-handedly, I don't think so. I'm not sure I can do anything single-handedly. I tried to put up curtains this weekend and couldn't do it, so I doubt I can change the world's perception of my race.
But you do think about that.
I think I have a sort of pop culture power that very few, if any, Native Americans have had before, and a literary image and power that very few Natives have had before. So I think part of that is my age, my young age, but I think part of it also is that I'm assimilated in a good way. I've always retained my Indian identity, my Indian politics. Nobody has ever identified me as anything else. But at the same time, I'm fully involved in all aspects of the culture.
Sherman Alexie is my guest today. We are talking about Native art and artists in America. Our next story is about the songwriter and musician Robbie Romero. He is an Apache who spent a lot of his childhood in Hollywood. His parents were in the film industry, and his mother even danced in an Elvis movie. But as he got older and started playing music professionally, he found his calling in Native rock, mixing flutes and hand drums with contemporary roots music. Minnesota Public Radio's Annie Baxter caught up with Romero on tour in the Midwest.
I'm driving through the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe's reservation in central Minnesota with Robbie Romero. The CD player trills with a song he's working on with his band Red Thunder. We're in Indian country. It's a term widely used by Native peoples as a kind of shorthand for the homelands and reservations. Romero has staked his claim here as a musician, much the way U2's identified with Ireland. Romero distributes exclusively in Indian country, and he rarely performs outside it. In the course of his career, that's meant leaving behind ambitions to be mainstream. Romero parks by a pretty spot at the lake on the reservation, and he tells me why the very idea of the mainstream is flawed.
There was a VH1 interview, an Inside Music, where they said that, you know, Red Thunder has a loyal cult following and is ready to cross over into the mainstream. Is the mainstream ready for Native rock? You know, I think the mainstream is ready for a lot of things that they don't get and don't have access to. I think there's some really wonderful Native artists out there that the mainstream would love. I think the music industry kind of categorizes Native artists as artists by race.
But Romero hasn't always been categorized as a Native musician. From an early age, he was playing guitar and writing original songs. He toured as the opening act for artists like country singer Ronnie Blakely and blues musician Paul Butterfield. He sometimes played in their bands as well. Romero grew up in New Mexico and Hollywood. His parents worked in the film industry. And when he was 12, the actor Dennis Hopper took him to see his first Native band, called Exit.
And they started the set with this traditional powwow drum and traditional singing, and they were all very much dressed in a very contemporary Native way, kind of like during the Indian Wars, how Geronimo dressed, how he was using contemporary clothing that he was... that was being introduced, but he was Indianizing it. He was making it Apache. He was making it his own. And these guys look like that. They look like that only in the 70s, and I never forgot that.
His serious interest in Native culture came a few years later.
At the end of my teenage life, I was pretty strung out on drugs and alcohol, and I got very, very sick, and, you know, my mother took me to a hospital, and, you know, and I got clean and sober there, and... You know, just got back on the red road and got involved with ceremonies and traditional way of life.
Soon, Romero was involved in the American Indian movement and became good friends with Dennis Banks, one of its leaders. They rallied around issues of sacred sites and the environment. Romero went on to write and direct several films about those issues, including Hidden Medicine. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 1998. He performed the music in the film with his band Red Thunder.
I feel... Medicine, yeah, waiting there for you. There's some hidden medicine. To ourselves, we must be true.
Woo! Romero has cultivated his identity as a Native artist, but that hasn't made him a household name on reservations. I asked around at a grocery store on the Mille Lacs Reservation in Minnesota, and I couldn't find anyone who knew Romero's work.
I'm doing a radio story about Robbie Romero. I was wondering if you've ever heard of him. He's a Native American pop artist.
Oh, no, I haven't heard nothing. No.
Do you listen to any Native American pop artists?
No, I don't even know who any are.
Romero says he's not discouraged if people don't know him. He's broadened his audience through his film projects, and he mentioned the 100 or so public radio stations that carry Native music. And at the end of the day, it's true he markets to Native audiences, but he thinks his work does have a wider appeal.
I don't really look at it as political or spiritual or environmental or social or any of those things. I think it is what it is, and I think it means different things to different people. It's just art.
For Studio 360, I'm Annie Baxter.
As the purple sunset fades, are we really here alone?
I'm Kurt Anderson, and I'm talking with Sherman Alexie about the art that Native Americans are making today. Sherman, have you heard of Robbie Romero?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I know Robbie Romero on Red Thunder and Exit, the band he was talking about. When I was in fourth grade on the Res School, we the Christmas pageant, we did a version of Oh Great Eagle and Exit songs. That's how big Exit were. But most of the music I listen to, my native artists, is powwow music. Black Lodge singers, Yellow Thunder, drum powwow music, drums and traditional singing.
So it's a real thriving world of art and entertainment.
The subculture art does very well in the Indian world. Bead makers, dressmakers, dancers, powwow singers. It's when you're talking about those Indian artists among us who are working in, for lack of a better term, what I would call mainstream genre work, are having a harder time. The thing to remember is that Native people are poor and very rural and poor inner city. So you've got Res Indians who, you know, like TV and rap music, and inner city Indians who like TV and rap music. So in a way, we Indian artists, especially us writers or painters or, you know, actors, are the elite who are working in a world, in an air that is above our Indian audience's expectations and needs and wants. To get to an Indian audience, you're going to have to work in the mainstream because they live in the mainstream.
Is that one reason you make films and do stand-up comedy?
Well, you know, listen, I'm a literary writer. I write short stories. I sell 50,000 copies of a book. But in terms of Indians, how many Indians read those books? I don't know. But I would venture that 95% of Indians have seen Smoke Signals. I run into, Navajo grandmothers who've seen it. And we screened the movie in Minneapolis a couple of years after it was in theaters, and the sound kept going out on the projector. But enough Indians in the crowd had seen Smoke Signals enough times that they started doing the dialogue. You know, it was the Rocky Horror Indian Picture Show.
That must give you tremendous pleasure.
It's one of the highlights of my life. I was crying in the back. It just has huge cultural power because it's mainstream. It's a road movie. It's Bing Crosby and Bob Hope with braids.
My guest today is Sherman Alexie. Coming up, we look at the legacy of Edward Curtis, whose photographs of Indians launched 1,000 cliches. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
I ain't got nothing, I heard no good news. I fill my pockets with those reservation blues. Those old res blues, those old reservation blues.
Studio 360 is proudly sponsored by Volkswagen of America and the Touareg SUV. Details at VW.com. On the road of life, there are passengers and there are drivers. Drivers wanted. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, offering almost 2 million used, new, and out-of-print titles on the web at powells.com.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. In a couple of days, the National Museum of the American Indian opens in Washington, and we're using this occasion to talk about what it means to be an Indian artist in the big mishmash of 21st century American culture. Sherman, we were talking earlier about your hugely popular independent film, Smoke Signals. As far as I know, it was the first film you had anything to do with. There's a great scene in the movie where the two main characters, who are young men from the reservation, get on a bus full of white people.
Don't you even know how to be a real Indian?
I guess not.
But no wonder, geez. I guess I'll have to teach you then, ain't it? First of all, quit grinning like an idiot. Indians ain't supposed to smile like that. Get stoic. No, like this. You gotta look mean or people won't respect you. White people will run all over you if you don't look mean. You gotta look like a warrior. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo. We were fishermen.
What? You want to look like you just came back from catching a fish? The same dances with salmon, you know? Thomas, you got to look like a warrior.
Now, where does the character Victor get his idea about what an Indian is supposed to look like?
The outside culture's opinion of what an Indian is supposed to look like. That's the real, the dangerous part of assimilation and colonization is when you completely adopt the dominant culture's idea of who you're supposed to be.
And our dominant culture's view of what Indians should be has for about a century derived pretty much from the work of a white photographer named Edward S. Curtis. Starting around 1904, he created his 19-volume set called The North American Indian, which is full of gorgeous, romantic, sepia-toned photographs, iconic images like a chief in a feathered headdress and a party of Sioux buffalo hunters pausing on a ridge. He shot scenes from everyday life, and he also took portraits of the most famous Indians then living, including Geronimo and Red Cloud. Curtis spent 30 years of his life going across America back and forth on this project. He wanted to document a vanishing culture, but he played set designer and costume designer on the pictures as well, changing how the subjects really presented themselves. As Peggy Berryhill reports, Curtis's legacy presents Indian artists and curators today with a dilemma.
My first reaction when anyone mentions the name Edward Curtis to me, or when I'm asked to think about Edward Curtis, is to say, oh no, not again. Oh no, why now? Why again?
I have this a special connection with Curtis, and I admire him for what he did.
I think his images are compelling. They're beautiful images aesthetically, but they, you know, are just so heavily embedded with inconsistencies, you know, where he used props and he has people wearing regalia that really doesn't have any meaning, or the meaning is backward.
Of course, most of those early photographers were only interested in the romanticism. They weren't interested in our struggles to survive.
Native scholars and artists talking about Edward Curtis, the 20th century photographer who captured thousands of images of Indians. For many non-Indians, these images from the lens of Edward Curtis have become the cultural stereotypes of American Indians. George Horsecapture.
Curtis was a great technician because he created these great photographs, but in the process, in my mind, our admiration is a little misdirected. We admire Curtis so much. When we look at one of his photographs, we're looking at the shadows and the backlit and, you know, all of this. But we don't appreciate enough, in my mind, the subject. You know, these people were hurting. Their strength and beauty comes through all the time. Their determination, their ability to survive. They all lived Buffalo Indian lives, which wasn't easy. You know, that should be appreciated as well.
That was George Horsecapture. He's from Fort Belknap, Montana, and is a curator at the National Museum of the American Indian. In 1882, Edward Curtis moved to Seattle. His first photo of an American Indian is of Princess Angeline, the daughter of Chief Seattle. Angeline was a digger and dealer of clams. Curtis wrote, "I paid the princess a dollar for each picture I made." This seemed to please her greatly, and with hands and jargon, she indicated that she preferred to spend her time having her picture made than in digging clams. It's in Seattle where his lifelong fascination with American Indians takes root.
Well, he's a romantic pictorialist. I find it real hard to just look at his images aesthetically.
Teresa Harlan. Harlan is former curator of the Gorman Museum at the University of California, Davis campus, and has spent the last two decades researching the photographic history of Native Americans.
I always have to look at the context that he worked in, and so his intent was to record the vanishing Indian. And he was actually celebrating that difference, that uniqueness about Native people, but it was still from his perception. And so that's why he is in that trouble spot that he's in, where he's well-loved and well-hated. But his images are provocative.
After being invited to photograph a Sundance in Montana in 1890, Curtis's primary passion became documenting the Indians in the Dakotas and Montana. And in fact, these images have served a purpose, providing a badly needed family history for some Indians. In the 1970s, a young Gros Ventre man, a budding scholar, found himself struggling to find his tribe's history and his own identity. He found them both on the same day with the help of a Jesuit archivist.
The Jesuit archivist is a very nice man by the name of Schoenberg. He says, you know about your grandpa's picture, don't you? And I said, no, I didn't know. Didn't know what he's talking about. So he led me back into the archives and twisted around in the back of things. And he dug down there a bit and he pulled this certain one out. And down in one corner of the picture was the name Horse Capture. And that was my great-grandfather. And on the other corner was the name E.S. Curtis. I met them both at the same time. I was so grateful that I was looking for an identity because there was nothing home. Now I could see who our great men were. I could see who performed these heroics on the battlefield and vision quested on the mountains. I could put a face on it. We were here. We burned three forts in Canada, and they never told us. And how many tribes have burned three forts? Not many. I mean, we were hellraisers, and that kind of feels good.
Curtis's sepia-toned prints have become evocative of a romantic past. He wanted to capture a vanishing lifestyle. But why was it vanishing? Raina Green.
When Curtis went out to do his work, Indians were in terrible trouble. The Indian wars were being initiated all over again out in the plains. Removal had occurred long ago out in the southeast. Indians were living under siege. Indians were having to respond to the government policies of civilization and assimilation, dragged off to boarding schools. And Curtis thought that he was photographing the end of the trail, the last ofs, I call them.
Perhaps it was Curtis's technical skill or his abilities as a myth maker that made his work so appealing to non-Indian consumers. It has stood as a record of days gone by and looms large over the work of today's photographers. Some Indian photographers have shown the reality of the results of government policies. In the 1970s, Richard Ray Whitman, a Yuchi and Pawnee Indian, focused his lens on the homeless Indians around Oklahoma City. He says his own life was sometimes lived on the same edge, and he understood them. Richard Ray Whitman.
I never set out to challenge the Curtis. Well, I began an early series in the 70s, which later became known as the Street Chiefs. I began to document homeless Indians, Indians on the streets, mostly males. For me, it was so obvious that here in one's own homeland that one could be homeless, landless. Then that became compared to Edward S. Curtis. There's always these references to Curtis, and I think Indian photography, Indian photographers can offer a more honest observation of our culture, of our people. We're not just passing through. We come from within. We participate in our cultures. We don't have to worry about being objective. So I think honest observations equals honest portraits, honest self-portraits of the complex people that we are.
Ironically, Whitman did not set out to be compared to Curtis, but Curtis's work seems to be the yardstick for all photographs of Indians. One native photographer, Dugan Aguilar, says that Curtis was his artistic influence.
He was, because I think I wanted to go out and kind of emulate his work. I mean, traveling around and documenting the American Indian.
Dugan Aguilar is Maidu, Pitt River, and Paiute. He's an exceptional photographer, and his work appears regularly in news from Native California, and his portraits of the California Indian basket weavers and California Indian storytellers is well known. He remembers the first Curtis photo he saw.
remember looking at the one, I think it's the Vanishing Race, where the Navajo is looking back. There's a row of horses, and they're going to, I think, Canyon de Chelly. And one of the Indians looks back, you know, at the camera. But this print was just, to me, it looked like it was a quarter inch deep in silver. I mean, I just couldn't get over the quality of his work.
Because Curtis's images overpower the present and trap Indians in the past, his work is both revered and despised. Indians didn't vanish, and they want to be seen as they are, representing over 500 tribes and bands still living in the United States. Raina Green.
I want someone to be able to look at Native people as they are now and not judge them by Curtis's standards, not see them through Curtis's lenses, not filter them through Curtis's filters, to be able to say, hey, that's a great picture of an Indian in the 19th century. I'm standing right beside someone who is very 21st century, and I can see them on their own, by themselves, in their own world, in the way in which they project themselves in the world. And I think that's the trick. But powerful art, powerful movies, powerful books do make it very hard to get through their lens. Especially if their lens is cracked. And for us, we don't need them to see through Curtis's glass darkly. We need them to see through the bright light of contemporary day.
For Studio 360, I'm Peggy Berryhill.
To see images by Edward Curtis, go to studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with Sherman Alexie. Sherman, do you have a take in that debate about whether Edward Curtis and his sort of late Victorian images of your people should be regarded with skepticism, loathing, pleasure?
Well, I sort of feel about Curtis the way I feel about male gynecologists now, that, you know, they were necessary in their time because there was no other game in town, but there's so much more going on that it just seems sort of icky now, and they're kitschy and superior and romantic, and I don't think there's any difference between Curtis photographs and, you know, Land O'Lakes butter now.
So you, for you, the objections are aesthetic and not somehow political.
I mean, not really. I just don't think the photos are relevant. So I you know, they're pretty. I have a couple books of Edward Curtis photographs, but, you know, I think they've been sitting on my bookshelf for 10 years and I haven't opened them.
Or are there images from Western films or any other places that have shaped your own view of American Indians?
Well, I mean, there are movies that did it positively for me. Those are the ones where the traditional looking guy was rowdy. Chief Dan George, for instance, in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, who appeared in Little Big Man and The Outlaw Josie Wales and a number of other Westerns who was not really an actor, but always played himself and was always highly contemporary, no matter what role he was playing. So you could see his grin through the role. And I love that guy. You know, his son played Lester Falls apart in Smoke Signals. So we continued the tradition of the ironic Indian. And so it was always irony that I appreciate about Indians. It's one of our primary modes of traditional communication is irony. I guess the best defense against colonization is irony, and Indians are very good at it. And if you look at the history of comedy, you'll find that the two funniest groups in the world are Jewish people and Indians. So I guess that says something about the inherent humor of genocide.
Well, there were blacks as well, of course.
Yeah.
To whom the same principle applies.
We're funnier.
Well, they're gonna inviting a smackdown, aren't you? Do you think that the incredible Indian casino boom of the last 20 years has, in a way, as powerfully as cowboy and Indian movies of the previous 50 years, shaped the way white people think about Indians, Indians think about Indians?
Let's put it this way. Casinos are a lot more dangerous than Edward Curtis.
How so?
I think casinos have changed us in ways internally that Edward Curtis's photographs could only affect us externally. I just find it sad that in our efforts to be sovereign and be the best we can be and educate our children, that we have to resort to the worst parts of capitalism. And don't let any Indian call it traditional. Crazy Horse never imagined a slot machine. And By and large, Indian casinos are loopholes for white corporations to make a lot of money.
And I suppose, as they do, plenty of Indians are making a lot of money as well.
Yes. What casinos have done really well is create class on reservations and in communities where class did not exist before.
Now there are rich Indians?
Yeah. It's easy to be tribal when you're all poor. It's much more difficult, you know, when you have an upper, middle, and lower class on a res.
When in your fiction you dwell on a negative Indian stereotype, you mentioned earlier in the show the crashed car with beer cans thrown outside, and in your story What You Pawn, I Will Redeem, there's an irresponsible drunken Indian character. Do either white liberals or Indian readers say, hey, Sherman, you shouldn't be doing that?
Well, to give you some idea, my book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven, was banned from being taught at the Coeur d'Alene public school. It was presenting negative images to young Indians. So I get that all the time. But, you know, my response to that is, you know, I'm a drunk. I've been sober for 11 years, but I'm a drunk. So in my art, it's necessarily a part of who I am. As an individual artist, alcohol is huge in my work because it's huge in my life. Even if I don't drink, it's omnipresent. And we don't even want to, I mean, out of my immediate family, cousins, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, you know, nephews, nieces, you know, 90% of them are addicts in one form or another. So I'm not writing stereotypes. I'm writing autobiography. I'm writing memoir. You know, and to think anybody who wants to deny the ever-present damage and destruction alcohol is causing in the Indian world is lying. And no sober Indian has complained about the depiction of alcoholism in my work.
Could you read something from that story, What You Pawn, I Will Redeem?
Speaking of alcoholism, What You Pawn, I Will Redeem. Noon. One day you have a home and the next you don't. But I'm not going to tell you my particular reasons for being homeless because it's my secret story. And Indians have to work hard to keep secrets from hungry white folks. I'm a Spokane Indian boy, an interior Salish, and my people have lived within a 100-mile radius of Spokane, Washington for at least 10,000 years. I grew up in Spokane, moved to Seattle 23 years ago for college, flunked out within two semesters, worked various blue and bluer-collar jobs for many years, married two or three times, fathered two or three kids, and then went crazy. Of course, crazy is not the official definition of my mental problem, but I don't think asocial disorder fits it either, because that makes me sound like I'm a serial killer or something. I've never hurt another human being, at least not physically. I've broken a few hearts in my time, but we've all done that, so I'm nothing special in that regard. I'm a boring heartbreaker, because I've never abandoned one woman for another. I never dated or married more than one woman at a time. I didn't break hearts into pieces overnight. I broke them slowly and carefully. I didn't set any land speed records running out the door. Piece by piece, I disappeared. And I've been disappearing ever since, but I'm not going to tell you any more about my brain or my soul. I've been homeless for 6 years. If there's such a thing as being an effective homeless person, I suppose I'm effective. Being homeless is probably the only thing I've ever been good at. I know where to get the best free food. I've made friends with restaurant and convenience store managers who let me use their bathrooms. And I don't mean the public restrooms either. I mean the employees' bathrooms, the clean ones hidden in the back of the kitchen or the pantry or the cooler. I know it sounds strange to be proud of, but it means a lot to me, being trustworthy enough to pee in somebody else's clean bathroom. Maybe you don't understand the value of a clean bathroom. But I do.
That was from What You Pawn, I Will Redeem by Sherman Alexie. And we'll find out more about Sherman Alexie and his work and being an American Indian artist today. We'll also find out what an Indian highway overpass looks like. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with Sherman Alexie. And we're looking at fiction and music and films and now design by and about Native Americans. There is Indian art all over Arizona, most of it in galleries and tourist shops. But the city of Tucson is celebrating one local tribe's artwork in a more civic-minded way now. Near the heart of Tucson's downtown, the city is building a pedestrian and bicycle bridge over a busy six-lane intersection. The bridge is designed with patterns like those on bear grass baskets made by traditional Tana Adam basket weavers. But the designer of Tucson's new bridge isn't a basket weaver, and she isn't even from Arizona. Rosemary Lone Wolf is a potter, a Tewa Indian from New Mexico. She learned about the importance of baskets in Tana Adam culture from weavers like Terrell Dew Johnson.
The story goes there's a lady sitting there weaving a basket, and they say when she's done weaving the basket, that's when the world will come to an end. You know, and so when she finishes her basket, she'll put it aside, then she'll get up and she'll walk to the west, walk into the sunset.
My name is Rosemary Lone Wolf, and I'm a Tewa Pueblo artist from Santa Clara Pueblo in New Mexico. I come from a family, I'm the fifth generation of potters. And so we have this tradition that dates back all the way to the cliff-dwelling times. If I'm working on my pots, that comes directly from my Pueblo Tewa background and the art form that I've been taught. But with the public art, what I try and do is to look at what the indigenous culture is in that area and try and reflect some of their designs. Their culture will have a voice in my art.
My name is Terrell Dew Johnson, and I'm from the Thonautum Nation. I am a basket weaver. Well, the significance of basket weaving is very strong and heavily rooted into the Thonautum culture. You know, they say that baskets were part of the creation story. Baskets help carry the burden of the people. So basket weaving is very sacred.
To go from pots that are, oh, just a little bit bigger than a nickel, all the way up to something that is spanning a highway. In my mind, for me, it was a monumental leap. For this particular piece, I used as my inspiration a basket that was actually in my own collection. So I just used the lizard imagery and the coyote track imagery. And when this is done, these are going to be steel cutouts that will be on the side of these steel support beams.
The coyote tracks on the design of the bridge is very significant for a Thonautum basket weaver. Coyote is one of the animals from the desert, so we respect and honor him through our baskets, through a design of his tracks. And then the design of the lizard is depicting a being that was part of Autumn life.
When I'd go to Arizona and you see all this public art, and a lot of it is Native symbols, I just thought, these people that are doing this work are Anglos, non-Indians, and they have no idea what the imagery means, and those that were using sacred imagery willy-nilly was really offensive to me. I mean, I knew it, and I wasn't even of that tribe. So I just thought, by golly, some of the Native people have got to stand up to the plate and start doing this.
We come from a background where, you know, we had things that were solely for our people and that were made and given to us by the Creator for our use, you know, but this artist is Native. So I think she understands the significance of designs and using them in some kind of public art setting like the bridge.
I think that in general, anyone would feel better if it was coming from your own tribal members. But at this point, I just view it as if I can get out there and be a voice for other people, then later on, maybe these people from their individual tribes will have the opportunity and the courage to go out and do it.
It's a shame a lot of people in Tucson don't know what's in their backyard. Sometimes is the scenery, the environment, but also the people. You know, we're desert people and we were here first. and for the city of Tucson to recognize that, it's just amazing.
Basket weaver Terrell Dew Johnson describing the native sources of Rosemary Lone Wolf's new bridge in Tucson. The bridge broke ground a few weeks ago, and you can see the design at studio360.org. Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler of KNAU produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the writer Sherman Alexie. Sherman, does it encourage you to see Indian art adapted by Indians to a civic sort of infrastructure like this in a big city?
Oh, I love that. I come up with a better word than assimilation. It's integration. There's a positive word. It's integration. And the way this bridge uses local art, not necessarily from the tribe itself, but from New Mexico to create this space, on a bridge, a pedestrian bridge over a 6-lane highway. I love that. And one of the theories and ideas I've been pursuing in my own mind lately is the sacredness of everything. And people always associate that with landscape and old buildings. But I've been doing my best to associate sacredness with everything humans build. And so when I look out the window and see an ugly building in Seattle, I remember that human beings made it, whatever it is, and that somebody fed their family with that. And that somebody drives by that building every day thinking, I made that. And so some people might think that putting native art on a bridge is sacrilegious or objectification. But I think it's blending the cultures in a way that's beautiful. And trust me, we all know that the car is sacred in the United States. So for good or bad. And yeah, I love it.
Do you think when you're 47 and 57, do you aspire to be no longer known as the great Indian writer?
Oh, I want to be all that. I'm Indian. That's never going to go away. The only thing I desire is that everybody be identified as what they are. The fact is that John Updike doesn't get called the Northeastern White Writer, and he should. That's what he is. And there's nothing. It's a description. So when people call me the Indian writer, that's what I am. It's a description, just as long as they keep calling everybody by their description.
I think of you in comparison to somebody like Philip Roth or Saul Bellow, who certainly were the great Jewish writers of their respective generations. I wonder if maybe you fulfill that slot and Indian writers after you won't have to be called Indian writers, just as Jewish writers who happen to be Jewish now are seldom called Jewish writers?
I think Philip Roth is a good example. Number one, I would love to be Philip Roth of the Indian world, to have that kind of cultural power and artistry. I'm not that good a writer. I hope I become that good a writer, that great a writer. But I think Philip Roth, in a lot of ways, he's not viewed as Jewish necessarily, or not described as being Jewish, because in a lot of ways he's rebelled against all that. So if I can serve as a gateway or a door through which other Native artists can become like the descendants, literary descendants of Philip Roth, that would be great. I gained a lot of power and confidence because of James Welch and Joy Harjo and Leslie Silko and Simon Ortiz and Adrian C. Lewis. And to think that I might have that effect on other Native writers is incredible. And I have high hopes for the museum. I know I'm going to be disappointed. I'm an Indian. I'm always disappointed. But I have high hopes for the museum that it can do that. I hope it rebels against the government. But the thing to remember, and this goes back to a lot of the discussion we had, is that the aesthetic of the museum is going to be controlled by very few Indians. A very small crowd of people have the power to determine what we see.
That's in the nature of museums, I guess.
Yes, but all too often we let one native speak for everybody. It happens to me.
And you're just one Indian.
And I'm just one Indian. And I'm Dwayne Bobick.
Sherman Alexie, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Sherman Alexie is a novelist, a poet, and a filmmaker. You can find out more about him and any of the stories you heard today on our website, studio360.org. We're going to close the show today with what may be the most unlikely act ever to play Carnegie Hall, Kiki and Herb. Kiki is a chanteuse. She's a lady of a certain age, and Herb is her collaborator and, if I may say so, long-suffering accompanist. They are the alter egos of Justin Bond and Kenny Melman. Together, Kiki and Herb perform twisted renditions of songs from Leonard Cohen to Eminem, and Kiki keeps up an intensely dark, complicated patter about her struggles with pretty much everything. The September 19th concert at Carnegie Hall is called Kiki and Herb Will Die For You. It's billed as their farewell performance. Kiki and Herb, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much, I think.
You are, to coin a phrase, one of the hardest working acts in show business.
Well, we've been performing since the mid-40s. Well, even really earlier than that. Yeah. You know, when Herb and I were young, we were contained in an institution. Now, to me, Herb's practically like a shadow, you know? But, you know, after what, 70 years, it's like...
Me and my shadow.
Yeah, you know, it's like there's nothing there, but yet it's everything. You know?
And the history that you've shared together, the places you've been, the incredible experiences you've had together, does that feed the creative process? Does that make you who you are as performers?
Hey, we're just a couple of song dance people. I don't know what this creative processing
is.
You know, people give me, I sing a song, I entertain the people, you know. I get out there, I do it. Yeah, I don't know.
Think
we have
much.
A creative process. Like, what the hell is that?
Just,
you know, I'm not, you know, Vincent Van. Yeah, I'm not cutting my
we
hair off.
We learned some new
anything.
Song and stuff. Yeah.
And what are you gonna? What will you play for us here today in the studio?
Well, we're
at the big Steinway,
you know, we're going to do a little medley of music that you know, sort of a hip kind of medley for the young people, basically.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kiki and Herb.
Thanks. Hey. You should have seen by the look in my eyes, baby, who there was something missing. You should have known by the sound of my voice, but you didn't listen.
I always listen to you.
Well, you played dead, but you never bled. And dead in life, still in the ground, all coiled up in his head. And though I known about all others may.
Now, a lot, you're masters, or should I say mistress and master of the medley.
It gets
well,
the songs
thank
over
you
quickly.
Very much.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a lucky, you know, what do they say? It's a lucky kind of thing that we're known for that because, quite frankly, part of the problem is that I can't remember the lyrics to an entire song, so I just, you know, go on to the next one. Hair's pretty good at picking up on those things, you know. So now I come to you with open arms. Oh! Can't you see? I think I can see now, baby. What your love means to me. Open arms.
And that was the fabulous Kiki and Herb. Kiki and Herb are the inspired creation of Justin Bond, who performed vocals, and Kenny Melman on the piano. Justin and Kenny.
Thank God.
Hello. Oh, now I have to get you.
Did you just start doing this one night and sort of...
Yep.
Actually, I did. I showed up for a party, and I was supposed to entertain, and I was in just such a bad mood, and... In the course of getting dressed, I created this character. I didn't have a cab fare. I was young. I was poor. And I was supposed to go to this boy's birthday party. I didn't have any money. I showed up in the cab as Kiki, got out and demanded they pay the cab driver. Just was insane, crazy person at this party. It was so liberating.
And the music, the songs, the medleys, how do you go about the two of you creating that part of the show?
We, you know, bring the songs to the table and, you know, I'm sort of a medley master. So, you know, it is sort of a
medley
strain.
Master.
You know, you can't get a job doing that really anymore. But, you know, certain songs fit into the Kiki and Herb universe and actually fill in plot points or fill in emotional points that aren't filled in. Like I've been saying recently, it's like creating a film score that underneath Justin's monologues is this score that's guiding the audience to different emotional platforms and stuff like that.
If we could, before we go... return to the world of Kiki and Herb, and if you can play us out and end Studio 360, I would very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We'd like to do a number that if we could write songs, we would have written one for ourselves about us. And we hope you enjoy it. Hey!
La 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 la.
I lay all my problems at Johnny Mathis's feet. I say, Johnny, Johnny, tell me, can you tell me how to live? All my hopes are unraveling, and I just lost my lease on my house without hope, doors and windows without peace. And with a wave of his jewel-encrusted hand across the glittering Las Vegas scene, he said, you've got to learn how to disappear in the silk and amphetamine. La, 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 la,
la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la, la.
That was Kiki and Herb, who we will now put in a limo for their trip to Carnegie Hall. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you've been listening to Studio 360. I hope you'll join us again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
David Krasnow,
Lital Molad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Benjamin Shaw,
Kate Saramek.
Our story on Edward Curtis was produced with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Additional support is provided by Volkswagen of America and the Touareg SUV. Details at VW.com. On the road of life, there are passengers and there are drivers. Drivers wanted. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, offering almost 2 million used, new, and out-of-print titles on the web at powells.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360... Every art has its particular tools of the trade.
When I started out, it was kind of a technological version of what we all did at kindergarten. We were working with scissors and paste and making these collages, which were actually showing up in your local theater.
The master film editor, Walter Murch. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.